You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
I'm Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's San Francisco studio.
And I'm Ed Ludlow. This is Bloomberg Technology, and it is technology earnings, Caroline, that continue to drive these markets. That's where the energy is, and that's where the news flow is.
And whether these after-hour moves are going to suck away some of that enthusiasm. Coming up, we've got to dig into Intel, of course, tumbling after a weak forecast, sending more semiconductor stocks lower.
Then our exclusive interview with FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr about how a nationwide TikTok ban would actually work.
And we asked ChatGPT to come with a market-beating ETF. We bring you the results.
So let's get straight into it with Angelo Zeno, analyst at CFRA. I mean, Angelo, I brought you that top-line forecast for the current period, but what were your takeaways from the Intel print?
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it in terms of maybe what's driving the downside in the shares after hours. The guide down, I think we're looking at sales down 40%. I think the outlook was the consensus was looking down about 24% or so. So that was really the big miss on that side of things. But I think, you kind of think about what's really driving the lower guide on the sales side of things. It's really kind of two factors, right? It's the kind of the weakness we're seeing on the PC side of things, but things are significantly weaker than I think most people anticipated. And when you kind of look at the Q4 numbers, I think PC sales down about 25 to 30% in the fourth quarter. So I think you kind of need further sell-in declines versus the sell-through before we kind of fully get to that bottom. And I think maybe the good sign is that sharp decline in sales guide maybe is hopefully a good indication that maybe we kind of get past this maybe by the second quarter. And then I'd say the other factor in terms of the sales guide is on the data center side of things. I mean, it'll be interesting to kind of see how weak things are there, but clearly a lot of inventory built up there. But I think that's kind of really what's driving the weakness on the guidance side of things.
Angelo, a lot of self-help needed, because otherwise, depending on ordering of components, they're depending on people working through their inventory. Are they doing enough self-help, particularly on the cost side?
When you look at the margins here, right, especially the margin guidance, the gross margin guidance here at 39%, I mean, I think the answer there is there's probably more that they need to do, or it'll be interesting to kind of really figure out what's going on the margins there, because 39% by far at this point in time, the lowest among our coverage universe within the semiconductor industry. So that in itself is saying a lot there. Now, the big problem here is they're looking to do a massive kind of undertaking in terms of technology transitions, 4 technology transitions in 5 years. Never been done within the semiconductor industry. They need to get this right. This management team needs to get it right first and foremost, even if it means losing money here in the near term, which is what's going to happen in the first quarter. So at this point in time, that is kind of the most important factor for them. They didn't provide any guidance here for 2023. My guess is the CapEx guide probably has to go down relative to what we saw in 2022. So they're going to look to do some things here.
Right.
They did announce some cost cuts in the third quarter a couple of months ago. They're going to execute on that. But at this point in time, it's hard to cut given what they've got in front of them.
Got it. Angelo, you mentioned there no full year 23 guidance in the earnings statement. I can confirm the earnings call has started and the company saying it is not going to give full year guidance for full year 23. They're also talking about the macro difficulties they're seeing lasting through the first half of this year, guiding to long-term PC market of 300 million units. Break it down to very simple terms for us. What is the problem for Intel?
First and foremost, I think the competitive environment has been by far their biggest issue in recent years, right? I mean, despite the fact that, you know, that they may allude otherwise, AMD has definitely been kind of chipping away in terms of market share, specifically on the data center server side of things, which has kind of been historically kind of a very good kind of profitable business for this company, and it no longer is, at least at this point in time.
Yeah.
So I think the competitive environment clearly is a problem for them. The cycle is the other issue for them here. I mean, being overly exposed to really two key areas of the market, one being PCs, which, you know, was a 350 million unit market in 2021, was down about 15 to 20% last year. Probably looking at this point in time, given the guidance, you're looking probably down at least 10% in 2023 again. So the cycle is another issue, specifically on the PC side of things, and now also on the data center side of things, which started in the second half of last year.
Angelo Zeno, great to have your instant analysis. Thank you, CFRA there. Meanwhile, let's get on to another key story. It's again about Salesforce. Sources saying that they may appoint new board members amid pressure from activist investors. Now, the list of possible appointments includes Carnival's former CEO, MasterCard's current CFO, and an investor, ValueAct's chief, in fact. Salesforce had, in fact, been working on refreshing its board for several months, we understand, as pressure, of course, continues to mount to boost profits and shareholder returns. Let's get straight to Ed Hammond. You broke the news. What would these individuals bring to the board?
Hi, Caroline. I think first and foremost, probably a prophylactic against the other activists who are circling this company. I mean, Starboard are there, Elliott are there. We think Jeff Ubben with his inclusive capital fund are there. And you see this fairly often in these bigger companies that might have several dissident shareholders, that they will strike a deal with one group and bring some of those onto the board. And as I say, it's often a way of really defending against some of the other activists and what they might see as some of the less savory claims against the company.
Why is Salesforce under attack from so many different activists right now?
I think a couple of reasons. The first is the less exciting, if you like, which is that it's just a safe bet. I mean, it's down, I think, 50% from its highs in 2021. But unlike some of the smaller companies they might normally target, it's unlikely to get wiped out. So you have quite a safe place to park your money one way or another. The other reason, and I think this applies to a lot of big tech companies, is it just doesn't have great corporate governance historically. And that has been okay when the market was rising and everything was looking great. But as soon as things start looking bad, these tend to be the first companies that get raked over by the activists. And you're seeing that in some other big tech companies as well. I also think there has been a sort of series of acquisitions that have been quite large and not necessarily that successful. And despite Benioff saying that he was going to slow down on that, he obviously has continued to do it. And I think stuff like that really is kind of a red rag to an activist, because they know that there will be some long-only investors, potentially even some retail investors, who have similar discontent about that.
So, Ed, when it comes to Tableau, when it comes to Slack, are we going to see such names as this push for disposals? Is it further cost-cutting? What sort of discipline do they want?
Yeah, it's a great question. And at this point, we don't know is the answer. I mean, look, Elliott have been most public in terms of their recent statements and said they like Benioff, they like the company, they want to work constructively. That usually is sort of activist code for let us into the boardroom, we will give you cover to make some job cuts that perhaps would be harder to make on your own or of your own volition. In terms of spinning off and separating assets, yeah, I think there is a case to be made for some divestitures here. But again, some of these deals that were struck at a fairly high point in the market, it's difficult to see Salesforce just exiting and getting anything other than a discount.
Bloomberg's Ed Hammond, terrific reporting. That scoop moving the stock to its biggest gain since November. Thank you.
National security concerns are concerns that we take extremely seriously. As we have disclosed in the past, we have had discussions with the US government, but I'm very confident that through the detailed discussions that we're going to have, we will come up with a solution that will reasonably address the national security concerns that the policymakers have.
TikTok CEO there, Shou Chu, that was at the Bloomberg New Economy Forum in Singapore back in November, addressing at the time national security concerns from the United States. And since then, those concerns, they've been building up. No action still from the administration. And some states have actually started to take it upon themselves to implement some curbs on the popular app, like, well, Texas, for instance, of course. Some universities there have now banned the app on their campus networks. Will it help? What more should be done? Let's bring in someone who's been pretty vocal on all of this, FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr. Commissioner, it is great to have some time with you. And you have been outspoken about the concerns you see around TikTok. What, from your perspective, can you as an FCC commissioner do? Is it about speaking out or what action can you take?
Yeah, we have some expertise and experience in this area at the FCC. We've dealt with Huawei, ZTE, China Mobile, a lot of companies with ties back to communist China that are involved with nefarious data flows. That's why I'm speaking out. In the main, though, the action here is going to come from the Biden administration, the Treasury Department, CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment, has been reviewing this for almost 2 years now. I think the reality is the tide really has been moving out on TikTok. I think it's had a very bad 2 months, and I think it's shifted now from a question of whether there's going to be some sort of ban or decoupling of TikTok from Beijing to a question of when that takes place. Now, TikTok is still spending a lot of money, millions of dollars, to avoid that, but I definitely think things are moving in the wrong direction for TikTok.
What about the direction from the administration? Do you think it will ultimately be them and CFIUS, the focus there? Or is it actually going to be Congress? Because we actually see across the aisle some agreement here.
Yeah, it could be both. As you mentioned, there's bipartisan legislation now in Congress, bicameral actually, in the House. Last Congress, Republican Gallagher, Democrat Krishnamoorthy, representatives have a bill that would ban TikTok nationwide. Obviously, the bipartisan agreement to ban TikTok nationwide on federal devices. And we have almost 30 states now that have done it. It could be the Biden administration ultimately that takes the final action here. I think it should be. There's precedent for this. We've used CFIUS before to unwind the purchase of Grindr based on having connections back to a Beijing-based entity. India has banned TikTok across their entire country. So I think that's the right direction to go here.
Commissioner Carr, good evening to you. With massive respect to your office, the FCC does not have a power or a remit to take action on this. So who are you backing to take action? Who do you think at a federal or state level actually sees some material change when it comes to regulating TikTok?
Yeah, I think FCC officials, we do have some expertise here, again, when it deals with companies that have ties to the CCP and the various data flows. But right, in the main, I believe this is an issue that the Treasury Department should take a look at. Really, I think the biggest leader on this has been Democrat Chairman of Senate Intel Committee Mark Warner. He has said that, quote, TikTok scares the dickens out of him, and he's been working with Senator Rubio and others on this. So it could be Treasury, it could be Federal Trade Commission, or as we talked about earlier, there's a lot of interest in the House, bipartisan interest in taking action there. So I think it's going to come from action on several fronts, states included. I don't anticipate this will be a core FCC issue itself, though.
Yes. Commissioner, you mentioned India. We went to our audience and asked them if they felt that what they saw, the action taken in India, could be replicated here in the United States. 77% of respondents said yes. It sets an important precedent. Does the action taken in India set an important precedent?
I think so. It's a really strong precedent. You know, India is obviously the world's largest democracy. So I think taking action in that context is very instructive. And again, there's two main issues here. There's national security, but also mental health. You know, on the national security side, TikTok came clean just last month and said, yes, in fact, they had been surveilling the locations of specific U.S. reporters who are writing negative stories about TikTok. That's sort of a nightmare scenario. Remember, we're at a point in time where TikTok has been engaged in negotiations with CFIUS, where they have every reason to be on their best behavior, and yet they were engaged in that type of nefarious conduct. Trust is the most important thing right now when you're trying to negotiate with the government. And if I was in the Biden administration at CFIUS, I'd be really disappointed if I had this draft agreement with TikTok that was in place over the summer, and you see this subsequent conduct. I think it just shows that I just don't see a path forward where you could cut a deal that will put airtight protections in place.
So ultimately, you feel a ban is the only way? It's interesting, the EU before was sort of not talking as tough, and now in their lexicon, the word ban has become on the tip of their tongue. We've also seen it from India, as we mentioned. Is there no way that a deal could be done with Oracle? No way that TikTok could convince there is a safe way of still continuing to operate in the U.S.?
Yeah, I just don't see it. As you mentioned, Europe is starting to sort of ramp up their activity. Just this week, I think government officials in the Netherlands banned TikTok from federal devices there. Again, it fundamentally comes down to trust. And there was leaked internal communications that Forbes got over the summer, and they showed that a TikTok official said that even if all these protections are put in place, this Project Texas that they talk about a lot that involves Oracle, that according to them, it remains to be seen whether product and engineering, meaning Beijing, could still get access to this data. So if officials inside TikTok aren't certain that these protections are going to be airtight, I don't think that we should think that they would be either. And again, if you look at analysts, one analyst in particular had a odds of a TikTok ban at around 10% this summer. And towards the end of last fall, they had upped it to 40%. That was before the bipartisan bill was introduced. That was before you saw some of these recent revelations. So I think things are moving in the wrong way. But again, we'll see. They're spending an awful lot of money to try to stop a ban or a decoupling.
Commissioner, there's one part of this equation we've not discussed, which is the TikTok user here in the United States. Lots of people love using that app. Many have told us they don't understand the risks. They're not well explained. Why should TikTok be banned? How would you justify it to them, those million plus users that are saying, we want this?
Yeah, again, it's twofold. It's national security and mental health. On the national security side, again, it's pulling all sorts of sensitive data, everything from search and browsing history, keystroke patterns, potentially, according to terms of service, biometrics, which includes face prints and voice prints. And for years, they misrepresented where this was going. Internal communications, again, show that everything is viewed inside China. That's why FBI Director Chris Wray and others are raising the alarm. But the mental health side is interesting as well. There was a recent report cited by New York Times that had accounts set up for 13-year-old girls that within a matter of 30 minutes was showing eating disorder, self-harm content. And flash forward to the version of TikTok that's available in China, Douyin, and it's not showing that. It's showing educational materials, museum exhibits, science experiments. So it's very troubling, both from a national security, data security side, but also the mental health side.
Okay, but the mental health issues have been leveled not just at TikTok, but at homegrown social media platforms. Instagram have often had to respond to such concerns. How, if we ban TikTok and users move perhaps to YouTube Shorts and Instagram, how do we prevent that sort of element happening here?
Yeah, there's a baseline level of privacy protections that we need to put in place. I'm actually open to taking a look at increased age restrictions for social media generally. A lot of this, to your point, goes to social media apps beyond TikTok. Again, I think there's something very unique about TikTok that's exposed by the fact that you can compare what it shows to kids in the U.S. versus kids in China. But I do think there's a broader issue we have to deal with here. It's sort of like how do you eat an elephant, though? It's one bite at a time. I think there's broader data flow concerns that go back to China with all sorts of applications and data brokers. But we've been looking at TikTok for 2 years. We have a big case developed on that. We should take that action. And then I think it makes it easier to then deal with knock-on case and say, well, this is like TikTok. We've dealt with it. That's what we've done in other contexts. Again, we went with Huawei first at the FCC, then ZTE, then China Mobile. I think that's how we sort of approach this broader issue.
Commissioner, I think what we keep hearing is we've been looking at this for 2 years. These things do not work. What I don't think Caroline and I are hearing from people in your position, from the companies, is an actual solution. Are you going to suggest that Apple or Alphabet through Google just don't make the app available through their stores? How are you going to actually make this happen?
Yeah, that's one appetite that that I've thrown out there, is this idea that you can look at Apple and Google and have them remove it from the App Store. Obviously, India is an example. Grindr is a precedent here in the U.S. where we banned an app through the CFIUS review, or at least in that case required the sale. I think all of those are potential actions that can be taken here. And I think TikTok actually is uniquely replaceable. Again, a lot of parents look at TikTok and they think it's like Facebook or Instagram or another social media where you're following a network of people you know. But in the main, with TikTok, you go on there immediately, you're being fed content from Beijing. So I do think it could be replaced with either another owner or another short form video application relatively quickly.
FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr, with thank you for your time and the robust conversation, frankly. And I know TikTok is a story we'll continue to discuss. Now, coming up, why Morgan Stanley fired some of its own bankers, fined, I should say, some of its own bankers, and how WhatsApp is at the heart of it. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Morgan Stanley has fined some of its own bankers, for some, more than $1 million each for conducting business on WhatsApp and other messaging platforms. And clearly, a painful reminder, particularly if you're senior, and this is perhaps when you're facing a million of a fine, Ed, rather than perhaps a couple of thousand, right, is how senior you are, how often you were perhaps already reprimanded, and sort of a point system here.
Yep.
But it's interesting that these banks are paying the fines themselves and then asking for their own employees to
fess up. They're literally clawing back bonuses already paid out because they're under that much pressure from the regulators to make sure communications for business are done properly. It's astonishing pressure from the SEC, the FCTC. Can you imagine being asked to give back a bonus? I mean, I can't. I have to say, the other story that caught my eye is the Bloomberg reporting around the NYSE and what was actually responsible. So for, according to a source in layman's terms, it was that they didn't basically turn on, off and back on again the backup system.
Human error. Basically, a deeply technological area that you're trying to ensure that there's never any disasters, and through one person and one personnel issue, a disaster ensued.
In the markets, that's right.
Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Caroline Hyde.
And I'm Ed Ludlow. This week, both of us in San Francisco. Now, after a growing chorus of layoffs across the technology industry at large, one company is going against the grain. The cloud software platform ServiceNow will not lay off employees in 2023. That's according to the company's CEO, Bill McDermott. So how is he going to keep that promise? Well, fortunately, Bill joins us now on the program. That's a pledge, Bill. So how are you going to keep it?
Well, we are the platform for end-to-end digital transformation. Customers today have two things on their mind. On one hand, they have to automate and improve their productivity and do a lot more with less. So they're really trying to take cost out of the business. On the other hand, they recognize that digital business is something they have to do well at. So they are investing, and they're investing for the long term. So if you're investing for growth or you're taking cost out of the equation with ServiceNow, you can do it on one platform. You can do everything on ServiceNow's platform. And that's what makes it so compelling.
Bill, all told, your stock rose 3%. Were investors cheering the pledge to not do layoffs, or were they cheering the financial results?
Oh, I think they're cheering the financial results. You know, we are growing at the rule of 58.5, meaning if you combine our revenue growth and our free cash flow margin, we are growing at 58.5. They say you're a world-class status at 40%. So we are doing something that no other enterprise software company in the world is doing. We're growing faster than all the others, but we're doing it in a profitable way, and Wall Street likes that. But more importantly, it's a reflection of what we're doing for great customers like the Schwartz Group in Germany. They're going for next generation retail, or the United States Army. They're serving their 1 million constituents, and they're doing this end-to-end on one platform to run all of their business operations.
You, of course, actually hired, added net people to your business in 2022, quite a lot of them. Would you make the most of some of the talent that's becoming available and hire more in this environment?
Yeah, Caroline, we hired 5,000 last year, as you know, and it's fantastic because on the ServiceNow platform, you can literally run all your business operations as a company or an individual on one platform. So this argument that young people or new hires are unproductive is not the case here at ServiceNow because they do all their work on the ServiceNow platform, which is a total sensation. So our productivity is fantastic with early in career folks or senior executives that just want to work for the best company in the business. We'll continue to hire. We're especially hiring in engineering and go-to-market professionals to take care of our customers.
Analysts out there saying, well, now you're saying you're hiring, but they're saying you're executing well in a tough environment. You're a man who understands activist investors. You dealt with them in previous times. You understand how to sort of navigate that. Talk to us, as other businesses face this environment right now, how are you looking to talk to your investor base, particularly when you have a stock that's at still pretty high multiples?
Yeah, Caroline, you're right. I mean, it is high multiples, but that's because the growth rate is so high. What I'm super proud of is that understanding, and this was also reinforced today by other media professionals, that the activist investors that are working with these other technology companies start the meeting off with, we need you to look at the benchmark, and the benchmark is ServiceNow. And then they say their growth rate is 28%. And then they look at their margin profile, and it's the highest in the cloud business. And then they show them our free cash flow margin, and they're like, we need you to be that. And that's how the meeting starts. So I take that with a hungry and humble attitude. We're humble because we know it's all about taking care of the customers and doing it super well with great employees. And we're hungry because we want to grow even more and even faster. Right. So I don't have an issue with activist investors, and I have worked with them in the past. I actually have a great relationship with Elliott Management and with Jesse Cohn. I think they're terrific. And at the time when I was with another company, they offered very good suggestions, and we built trust, and we did a lot of cool stuff together. But here, I don't think this is the first place they'll stop because it's so successful.
Does your company thrive in difficult times? Because I think you were talking about customers moving away from different individual vendors and basically coming to you for a one-stop shop solution. But when customers do that, it's often because they're having to look and make changes reactionary. You see what I mean?
Yes, I do, Ed. I mean, here's the situation. If you believe the independent research companies like IDC, they will tell you that IT spend for software will grow in double digits this year. So that's a fact, an independent research fact. But let's assume that didn't happen. And let's just assume there was no increase in IT spend. What's happening now with customers, when they have three or four technologies that do something similar, they're saying, let's cancel three and go with the one that's the best alternative. We don't want all four. And during the hype cycle of the whole pandemic, where people were trying to figure things out, they just bought every point solution they can get their hands on. And now they want to really go for platforms that matter. So what ServiceNow is enabling companies to do is really consolidate the spend, move away from platforms that don't matter, and increase your productivity quite dramatically on one that does. So take cost out, go for ServiceNow. Put growth in, go for ServiceNow. All on one platform for end-to-end digital transformation.
It's interesting. You are such a positive person, it sounds like, and in many ways, rightly so. I'm looking at your analyst recommendations. Basically, 36 of analysts say buy your stock. There's only one holdout, one underperform who thinks your stock's going to drop, and that is Stefan over at BNP Paribas. What one thing would you say to Stefan? What's he getting wrong, or what is there one thing that does keep you up at night that you're trying to tackle that reconvinces that sell?
Well, I got to go speak with him. I think he has to have a meeting with me or come talk to our people or see our technology. We probably haven't spent enough time with him. But I guess one out of 36 isn't too bad. I would just tell them, like, if you look at where the new economy is going, this is a platform economy. And in this economy, you have the hyperscaler clouds, which are all very relevant outstanding companies, and they're going to do very well. And then you have a couple of SaaS companies, and among those couple of SaaS companies that matter, we are one of them. What's unique about us is whether you're doing workloads in a public cloud, a private cloud, or in a multi-cloud formation, ServiceNow serves as the control tower for end-to-end digital transformation. If anyone understands the implications of that and the network effect that that creates and the fact that we have the stickiest, most loyal customers in the business with retention rates near 100%, and we grow same account revenue growth nearly 30% per customer, plus we're getting lots of new business. We had a new business surge in Q4. I find it hard to understand why anyone wouldn't have a buy rating on that stock. The other thing from an individual investor perspective, hey, look, the whole thing, Caroline, as you know, the tightening monetary policy is what compressed the multiples, especially in high tech. But as that now gets more normalized, you want to be in the companies that have the ability to give you tremendous leverage, because once that tightening of the monetary policy lessens, loosens, gets more normalized, everybody in 24 hours or 48 hours is going to jump on the bandwagon to get in high leverage growth stocks like ServiceNow. And you want to be there before that 24 or 48 hour rush, or you're going to miss out.
Your time in the market, Bill, your time in the market. ServiceNow CEO Bill McDermott, great to have some time with you as always. We thank you.
Caroline.
Meanwhile, let's talk... Meanwhile, let's talk about Amazon, selling a vacant Bay Area office complex, in fact, purchased during the pandemic. Now, the company paid $123 million for the 29-acre property in 2021. It's the latest effort to unwind a pandemic-era expansion that left it with a surplus of warehouses and of employees. The Bay Area's office market has been hit hard, of course, in the past 2 years as companies pivoted to remote work and gave up real estate to cut costs.
Now, coming up, the VC industry is booming. With interest in artificial intelligence, we'll speak with Insight Partners who've been at it for a little while now when it comes to AI. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Should you be using ChatGPT for investment advice? Look, this is a natural language processing technology. Numeracy is not its strong point. So if you ask it to pick certain stocks to outperform in an ETF, it's probably going to sit on the fence. But it might entice you to decide to look for actual investments that use the power of AI. For example, there are a couple of ETFs that are outperforming the market using artificial intelligence, like the AI-powered equity ETF. It's got about $100 million in assets under management. It scrapes information from the internet and regulatory filings to help its over 6,000 stocks that it analyzes pick, reorientate, and outperform. We've also got the likes of a State Street fund, $1.7 billion in assets under management, and it itself is powered by IBM Watson. It too is finding the right sort of stock to be picking and is up about 10% on the year so far. The one thing that ChatGPT might incentivize you to do, though, is stay diversified. When you ask it about trying to find a balanced portfolio, it will recommend that you sort of spread your investments across various asset types to find uncorrelated returns. Hear that, folks? Be diversified. It's not that strong at maths, Ed, but it is, of course, a focus of a company that is trying, when you ask ChatGPT what to be doing with your investments, it sits very much on the fence. It's saying, like, you know, you can lose money or you can gain it, but it was really interesting to try and tell where you should be investing and what the power of AI is in your investments. And what's so funny is now a load of companies, Ed, are starting to try and make out that they're using AI, right? In the same way that we used to see perhaps like, right, blockchain, when it became blockchain. Now everyone started to put blockchain onto the end of their names and it gave their stock a pop. We've just seen some other companies start to say that they're harnessing the power of AI.
I don't know how to get my head around this because I thought the whole point of ETFs in particular was to be about passive investing. And you're asking artificial intelligence to help you with... It doesn't even bear going there. Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld wrote a brilliant story about it on The Terminal and on Bloomberg.com. Go and read it. Is it active? Is it passive? If a bot does it for you? I don't know.
But talking about companies trying to get on the bandwagon of harnessing AI, OpenAI, of course, which is the company behind ChatGPT, well, it's big, all the buzz over at BuzzFeed, because BuzzFeed is planning to use OpenAI to bolster some of its own content creation, we understand. The news sent shares surging at one point, more than 200% on this Thursday. BuzzFeed's market value at one point, therefore, hitting $400 million. Let's get to it with Alicia Diaz. And Alicia, I mean, what ultimately will this help BuzzFeed do?
Yeah, so I think that the main point here is for BuzzFeed sent a memo out to its staff today saying that this is going to help them bring a lower cost to the content that it produces. And I think we've seen AI a lot in the tech space in terms of with algorithms. I think that's where a lot of us are the most familiar with it. But it is really interesting to see that they are actually wanting to implement it with the content that it's creating. It'll be a show to see how this plays out, I think.
So the pitch here is replace journalists with artificial intelligence, which for the three of us, I imagine, is an uncomfortable thing to discuss. So let's talk about what Wall Street, Alicia, is saying about this partnership. I mean, the stock reaction says it all, really, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you said, definitely different groups of people who have different opinions on this. Clearly, Wall Street is excited at the idea of AI. We saw share volume go absolutely bonkers today with over 200 million, share exchanges happening. So I think that analysts are excited and have a generally positive outlook about AI. I think that there is probably more to come. You know, I think that this is just the beginning of the discussion. And as we learn more about the outline of when BuzzFeed plans to implement this, I think that that will hammer down how analysts are viewing it.
Bloomberg's Alicia Diaz, really looking into the applications of OpenAI for BuzzFeed. But of course, AI, artificial intelligence, and indeed generative AI could really disrupt most parts of industry, it feels like, right now. And every VC we talk to seems to be discussing that maybe this is a new tipping point. Lonnie Jeffy is one of them, managing director of Insight Partners, which has been tracking AI. You've been tracking machine learning startups and scale-ups since 2016. You've been taking stakes in some of them. And Lonnie, you said in particular that this is perhaps feeling like the early launch of the internet itself. Why so? What's so important and impactful about generative AI?
I think, you know, before the release of ChatGPT, many people had been underestimating the progress that AI has been making over the last few years and will make going forward. it was kind of like the spark that lit the fire of startup innovation around generative AI, and it also created a renewed fundraising dynamic. One way to think about it is that we've gone from these systems of prediction, like classification or recommendation systems, to these systems of creation. And so you now have these really interesting, powerful generative systems like our portfolio company Jasper, which can help you write a blog post, or Stable Diffusion, which can generate images, or GitHub Copilot, which can help write code. And we'll likely see copilots emerge with the ability to create first drafts for all sorts of other functions besides programming. You know, eventually medical documentation, legal contracts, school lesson plans, and things like that.
The thing for me, Lon, is it all comes down to money. It always comes back to money, right? And the team over at Sequoia Capital writing this research report recently that AI has the potential, particularly generative AI, to generate trillions of dollars of economic value. How do we get there to actually, you know, implement AI in a way that leads to value creation or products and services we can actually charge for?
It will be very interesting to watch where the pools of value will accrue and where the economic moats will be the deepest with these new generative AI technologies, if anywhere. Some people believe that the economic power will go to the companies that are building the large foundation models because they require so much time and skill and money to create, like OpenAI and Google and others. And some think that the moats will be deepest with the companies that are fine-tuning the models for specific use cases because they can enjoy things like demand-side economies of scale from having proprietary training data or a flow of feedback data from users. But I think it's a little early. It's still the fog of war around it all.
Lonnie, your CV is fascinating. We just showed some of your portfolio companies on the screen. You interned at Microsoft in your earlier years. You worked at IBM. Who is going to get there first? Big tech company like Microsoft or the more nimble startups that you're investing in now?
I think the rise of generative AI in particular could help to democratize access to AI technology because it can be delivered as a service. It's such a versatile capability, these foundation models. It may be easier for regular companies to consume and without being quite as deep tech. But I would say it's also important to remember that it's not just the generative AI companies that are making transformative impact. In the kind of more traditional AI, like in computer vision AI and healthcare, for example, we have a portfolio company, Overjet, where the CEO, Warda, and her team have built powerful technology that can tell you whether your tooth needs a filling or a crown based on its reading of a dental x-ray, or Iterative Health, which can apply computer vision to colonoscopy videos in real time. It can catch cancerous polyps missed by a gastroenterologist, which can be hugely impactful for healthcare. So there's going to be a lot of progress over the next couple of years. I think it'll be pretty fun to watch.
Lonnie Jaffe, we're looking forward to watching it along with you. Managing Director of Insight Partners, thank you so much for joining Caroline and I on the show.
Going viral today. Well, have you seen it already? The new teaser for the season 4 of HBO's Succession. Now, the March 24th season premiere was trending across all of social media, basically. HBO says an average of 6.1 million viewers watched season 3, up 56% from season 2, and the season 3 finale held 1.7 million viewers who tuned in live. But, Ed, what's interesting is we keep saying, oh, Succession, White Lotus, right, some of these key talked about ones, but actually, if you look at the numbers, they're not some of the most popular.
They're not. There's a target audience. I get why, you know, the Bloomberg family would be into Succession, the money behind it, the stories.
The art reflecting reality, perhaps.
But there are fans out there. I mean, this is going viral, right? I went to Twitter, hashtag Succession. The video on Twitter has, you know, 1.5 million views when I last looked. People get excited for this and they get talking about it because they love the stories.
But look at it compared to like Young Sheldon. Average audience, 7 million. So way more than Succession.
Yeah.
Yellowstone, season 5, is getting 12 million in terms of their overall viewership. So perhaps as much as the furor it gets, perhaps maybe just Succession is really good at marketing itself on social media.
It's a case of know your audience, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
And maybe we're it. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. To our own audience, from here, at least from San Francisco, I've got to get on a plane.
Thank you for being here. Don't forget, check out our podcast and everything we've got coming up this week. This is Bloomberg.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. the next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.